Donald Trump and I have two things in common. One, of course, is our fine heads of hair, and the other is that neither of us drink. Now, the fact that I'm virtual teetotaler should disqualify me for the next interview, but what the hell? It's with someone who knows everything that you could possibly know about imbibing. Max Allen, longtime neighbour of mine in the Weekend Australian, and these days he writes a regular column for The Fin, as well as other important mastheads. He's written over a dozen books about wine. His latest is called Intoxicating, 10 Drinks That Shaped Australia, published by Thames and Hudson. Hello, Max.
G'day, Philip.
Now, your new book is, of course, a cultural and social history of changing fads and fashions, but it starts, for me, in the most interesting way. You open with a challenge to the notion that Australia was a dry continent, and you're not talking about low rainfall.
I think if you asked most people in Australia when alcoholic drinks arrived here or when people started drinking fermented drinks in on this continent, everybody would say 1788. They'd all talk about rum. They'd talk about the rum that the first fleet brought with them. They'd talk about the rum rebellion. They'd talk about the dreadful scenes of intoxicated, orgiastic behaviour that arrived with that first fleet. And the truth is, and that's why the first chapter covers this, of this book, that that's just not true. There were fermented drinks made right across this country and the Torres Strait Islands before Europeans arrived and brought their own grog with them.
Let's begin with something called Whalena.
Whalena is the fermented sap of a tree, a eucalyptus in Tasmania called the cider gum tree. That's the name that the Europeans gave to this tree because of this drink that they witnessed Aboriginal people enjoying, consuming in the central highlands of Tasmania. So anybody who's been up to the Great Lakes around Miena, they might be familiar with some dead and dying eucalypts in that part of the world. Those trees are Eucalyptus gunnii. They're called cider gums because in the 1830s and 40s, when people like George Augustus Robinson travelled through that country, they witnessed and recorded scenes of Aboriginal people tapping the trees and then letting the sap pour out of the tree, down the bark and pool in a hollow at the bottom of the tree. And then, very importantly, they would leave that to ferment naturally. Because wherever you go in the world, there are yeasts in the environment. And wherever there's sugar, those yeasts will convert that sugar into alcohol. And then people enjoyed this drink. And very importantly, they became intoxicated.
My fascination with ancient Egypt taught me that the Egyptians invented a form of beer. In fact, it was called pior, a very similar word. Mm. And it was made out of fermented bread. But I had no idea. I'm quite shocked to learn that Indigenous Australia were brewers. And, of course, there's others. There's Cambuda, Tuba, Bial. Tell us about some of the other Indigenous fermentations.
So I first came across all these drinks in the work of Maggie Brady, who's a social anthropologist at the ANU and has written about this quite extensively. And she's also written about the relationship that Aboriginal people in Australia have had with grog over the last 200 years. I read about these drinks, the Cambuda in the Northern Territory. There's an amazing drink that I'd love to try one day that is made in the Queensland Channel Country in the southwest of Queensland, which is the flowers of the Bohinia tree mashed up and fermented with sugar bag honey, whether that's from...
Sounds great. I feel like taking up drinking.
The thing about it was that none of these drinks on the Australian mainland or on Tasmania would have been very strong. So whether it was this drink in Queensland, whether it was a Banksia nectar drink that was made in Western Australia, by the way, these aren't just historic drinks. There are also contemporary accounts of Aboriginal people making these drinks. They would have been mild. They were mild. They are mild. So only about 2, 3, 4% alcohol, and also very seasonal and connected with ceremony and connected with cultural practices.
I'm talking to Max Allen, wine drinker and wine writer extraordinaire. You introduce us to Aboriginal elder and horticulturist Noel Butler and his wife Trish from the New South Wales South Coast, and he shows you native grapes or berries, and at his invitation you try turning them into wine. What happened, Max?
Well, you'd have to read the book to find out what happened to those native grapes. Not to give too much away, they didn't make successful wine. So I first met Noel about 5 years ago and was amazed when he said to me, why has nobody made wine from these native grapes? And I thought I knew a fair bit about native ingredients, because a lot of drinks producers in Australia have been using native botanicals in gin and vermouth and beer and all these different types of drinks. Never heard of native grapes, or never heard of anybody making a fruit called native grapes into wine. So I went and visited Noel and Trish in the bush on Yuin country down near Ulladulla on the south coast of New South Wales. We went out, we harvested these grapes. They look just like very loose bunches of like Cabernet or Shiraz. Anybody's familiar with those grapes growing in vineyards around Australia. And we mushed them up back at Noel and Trish's place in the bush, and they formed this kind of, I don't know, snotty kind of egg whitey mass. It wasn't very pleasant at all. So they clearly weren't going to make wine of their own accord like wine grapes do. But we found other ways of turning them into drinks, where you can infuse the grapes into spirit, for example, to make an infused spirit, that were really quite exciting.
You tell us about green ants in gin, lager beer from wattle seed, condon liqueur, wildflowered flavoured beer. That's an astonishment on every page. Tell me about the French concept of terroir, I think that's how you pronounce it, and how that relates to the indigenous connection to country.
The French had this word, terroir. Its root is in the Latin terra, which we know as earth, but we also know that word territory. So terroir is this idea.
And
that,
indeed, terra nullius.
Terra nullius, it's a familiar word in our language. Terroir sounds all fancy because of the way you pronounce it in French. It just means that things taste of where they're from. So a wine that is grown on the famous slopes of Burgundy will taste a certain way because of the soil, the aspect of the hill to the sun, the rainfall, and very importantly, the culture of the people who've been growing grapes there for centuries. So it's this combination of culture, of the country and the climate. And about, oh, I don't know, 18 years ago or so, an Australian wine grower came up with this idea that the French concept of terroir, which is a strong connection to country, was very similar to the Aboriginal notion of belonging to country. And perhaps that there's a conversation that could be had here between wine growers and anybody who's producing anything off the land that we eat or drink that tastes of where it's from, and the Aboriginal community, because there's a shared understanding of our place in Australia.
I've watched with fascination the way the French have reclaimed their areas and declined to have them used by winemakers in other countries, and this has had quite an impact in Australia. But the modern day interest in indigenous ingredients and native flavours perhaps brings us to the complicated question of intellectual property.
Absolutely, and that's why this shared root of terroir and territory is important, because this idea of territory is something that it belongs to you and that you will protect from other people. So the concept of terroir is a French one, and the French are fiercely protective of it, because it's their intellectual property, exactly as you say. The wines of Burgundy only come from Burgundy, and anybody, God forbid, around the world should call their wine Burgundy, like we used to do in Australia until about 20 years ago, you know, the full force of the international law will come down on those people. So there is this very strong connection between a sense of place through flavour, a sense of place through quality, and something that is worth protecting. And this is a conversation that I had with Noel and Trish after I made these drinks and explored the potential of these native grapes is, well, what happens now? What do we do with this? This is Noel's suggestion. It's something I've done with him in a spirit of cooperation and, in a way, reconciliation. But I don't want to make money from this. I've just been doing it because I'm curious to find out what these native grapes taste like, in the same way that I was curious to taste the Wayalina off the tree in Tasmania. But should I now profit from that process? And if I do, how do I do it in the right way?
If you were to visit the farm, Max, I could give you a little bit of an ancient Egyptian fruit that you could nibble on. I wouldn't recommend it. It looks like a dried ear. But I understand that you've had the chance to sample some equally unusual things. Tell me about drinking a 150-year-old Champas from a shipwreck in Port Melbourne.
Yeah, so this was 25 years ago, when I was just starting out as a wet behind the ears wine writer for
wet
for
with the wine, age. I assume.
Wet with, absolutely, yeah. Dabbed with Chardonnay every morning before I went out to work, and I was lucky enough to be invited to a tasting that the museum put on, that Heritage Victoria or the Archaeological Survey had organised, of some bottles that were rescued from the bottom of Port Phillip Bay that had sunk in 1841. And there were champagnes, there were sweet wines, but the champagnes were fascinating because the eminent French winemaker who tasted them swore that he could still taste the Pinot Noir and the Chardonnay in this wine. And when I was, somebody very kindly snuck me a little tiny taste of this kind of murky brown liquid. And it tasted like, I don't know, it tasted like wine mixed with stale oyster juice. It was really not very pleasant. I couldn't taste the
How do you know what stale oyster juice tastes like?
Don't you have stale oysters all the time? No. You can imagine. I mean, this is what I have to do in my job all the time, is imagine what things taste like.
Well, take me back to when you were wet behind the ears with the daily dabbings. How did you get into all of this, this arcane interest of yours?
It's not arcane. Everybody loves wine, don't they, apart from those people
not
who
me.
Drink? I fell in love with wine so I grew up in England. I was always interested in flavour. I was a bit of a nerd as a kid. I remember reading newspaper articles where they'd get chefs and people to taste, you know, baked beans and rate the best. Those kind of articles used to interest me. And I remember young teenager, when everybody else was going out and drinking alcohol and smoking cigarettes and exploring the more adventurous side of life, I was at home tasting different brands of lemonade to see which one I liked most. So that's the kind of guy.
Well, of course, that sort of taste test became a huge marketing thing between Coke and Pepsi, didn't it? Well, you weren't alone in that.
Perhaps that was the inspiration as well. But what the important thing was, I saw it on television or I read about it in the newspaper, but I wanted to go and try it for myself. And that's exactly the same thing that took me down to Tasmania, that took me to the bush to go and taste these native grapes with Noel and Trish, and has seen me trawling through eBay buying old bottles of crazy liqueurs just to see what these things tasted like 100 years ago or what these things could taste like in the future.
I knew Len Evans a little, and he, of course, features in passing in the book. And he, in popularising the industry, said wine was just a bloody drink, but you profoundly disagree.
Len, you can't write about drinks, and certainly you can't write about wine in Australia over the last 50 years without talking about Len. Len was a garrulous, headstrong raconteur, full of life, full of enthusiasm for his favourite topic, full of enthusiasm for a lot of things, and he turned a generation of Australians onto wine. There's no doubt about that. But he had this populist image that exactly as you say, that it's just a bloody drink. Now, in the 1960s, when people were really seriously intimidated by the whole concept of wine, that worked wonderfully well. But as I've found very early on when I visited vineyards and tasted wines that honestly, to me, taste magical. The fact that you can pick up a bottle or a glass of what is just fermented grape juice and be transported to a place on the other side of the world through flavour means to me that it's not just a bloody drink.
I have a problem, and that is that when I read, and I accept you from this criticism because you're never pompous, but when I read wine writers, they're... it's often just so nonsensical, so pretentious. It sounds to me as abstruse as theology.
We struggle in the Anglophone world with the useful and complex language for flavour. It's not just wine. Read coffee tasting notes. Read perfume marketing spiel. Read anybody trying to describe the flavor of something to somebody else. We just don't have the language that, for example, the Japanese do when they're describing the unbelievably complex shades of different types of sake or soy sauce. We just haven't developed, for some reason, in the English-speaking world, the kind of language that is really very helpful. So we are forced to resort to metaphor, to ridiculous, increasingly florid language. I do it myself. I actually quite enjoy it.
I ask you a very personal question?
Yes, you can.
Because we're running out of time. I'm aware that when wine tasting is going on, it is customary to spit the wine out, but it still seems to me that you are placing yourself in mortal danger getting through as much grog as you did. Is the industry full of alcoholics?
Yes, but you won't get anybody to admit it. This is something I learned very early on, that the people who are attracted to alcohol, I think all have to ask themselves, alcohol as a profession, whether it's making it or selling it or writing about it, have to ask themselves a question: are they functionally alcoholic because of their profession, or are they the kind of person who was functionally alcoholic first and have found a profession in which they can kind of blend in? We have to be very careful. I think everybody who works with grog, I think there's a lot of very potent conversations that are going on right now because of the drinking patterns and how they've changed or are potentially changing with the pandemic. Now we're locked inside, and or certainly here in Melbourne again. And so I think the time is right now to be having these conversations about how we drink, how we see drink, and how we want to see drink in the future.
Max, good to talk to you, my old comrade from the Weekend Oz. Max Allen. Yes, one of Australia's leading wine and drinks writer, and he was apparently sober during that conversation. His new book, Intoxicating, 10 Drinks That Shaped Australia, published by Thames & Hudson. We only hinted at the contents of his fine tome.